Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. 40 million people in seven Western states, 29 federally recognized tribes, and northern Mexico depend on the Colorado River, but it's drying up fast. The climate crisis is accelerating the river's decline, which faces a number of problems, including water allocation rights, rapid development, and water-intensive crops. In a recent piece, ProPublica's environment reporter Abram Lustgarten examines the underlying reasons for the Colorado River's decline. He writes that for years, experts in the American West have predicted that unless the steady overuse of water was brought under control, the Colorado River would no longer be able to support all of the 40 million people who depend on it. It's important to note that about 70% of water delivered from the Colorado River goes to growing crops. A majority of the water used by farms goes to growing non-essential crops like alfalfa and other grasses that feed cattle for meat production. Much of those grasses are exported to feed animals in the Middle East and Asia. Short of regulating which types of crops are allowed, which state authorities may not even have the authority to do, it may fall to consumers to drive change. Water usage data suggests that if Americans avoid meat one day a week, they could save an amount of water equivalent to the entire flow of the Colorado each year, more than enough water to alleviate the region's shortages. Joining us to talk about the Colorado River and its future is Abram Lustgarten, a senior reporter investigating the climate crisis for ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. Hi, Abram. Thanks again for writing such an important piece.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Well, let's go over a couple basic facts. Over 40 million people rely on the Colorado River. As you report, large portions of Phoenix, Denver, and Los Angeles depend on this river. A third of Southern California's drinking water comes from the river, and the power generated by two big dams, the Hoover and Glen Canyon, is marketed across an electricity grid that reaches from Arizona to Wyoming. So, Abram, this is one of the country's most important sources of fresh water.
Yeah, absolutely. It's clearly essential. In addition to the stats you just ticked off, a large amount of the nation's winter fruits and vegetables are also grown with Colorado River water in Southern California. So the grocery store shelves, you know, stacked with carrots or lettuce in New Jersey or Massachusetts likely, come from the region as well. West of the Mississippi, it's probably the single most important source of water.
Now, you've been there. Can you just give us a sense of what the Colorado River looks like for those of us who have not been there?
Well, yeah, it's a place I've spent a lot of time. The Colorado stretches about 1,400 miles from its headwaters high in the Rocky Mountains all the way to the Gulf of California between Baja and Mexico. The landscape is dramatically different as it stretches between those varied locations. So, it's a clear rocky stream, a Rocky Mountain stream at its higher elevation. And becomes, sort of a slow-moving torrent, of muddy water in red canyons as it moves south through, along the borders of Arizona and California. And in between is in, goes through the famous desert country like Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell that you mentioned.
And it's amazing to think that this river provides water to so many people and so many farms. 40 million in seven Western states, 29 tribes and northern Mexico. That is a lot of people and a lot of farms.
Well, you want to go back in history to the time when, the Western United States was settled and developed, and John Wesley Powell, ran his expedition to the Western United States to survey what kind of resources would be available. And at that point in time, had essentially concluded that there wasn't enough water in the West to support really, an economic or a national expansion into the region, except for this one resource. And there was the Colorado River, and it sort of ran in its deep canyons, especially in a southern portion, and was virtually inaccessible. But he concluded then, and President Roosevelt concluded then, that, should this river be harnessable, it could probably be disseminated enough to make it possible to, you know, to live in the West. And so from the very beginning, you know, with some exceptions in the far Northwest and places like Los Angeles, the development that we've seen across the entire Southwest and Western United States has been, you know, made possible either directly or tangentially because of the Colorado River.
And you write that over the years, the states that rely on the river have overdrawn the river's average deposits. You write, it should be no surprise that even without the pressure of climate change, such a plan would lead to bankruptcy.
Yes, so this is just basic math. When the seven states that share the river signed an agreement in 1922 to decide, you know, how they would divide up the share of the water that they planned to use, they arrived at an estimate for how much water would flow through the river, and that estimate turned out to be wildly optimistic. In the decades that followed that 1922 agreement, it became clear that the river wouldn't normally provide anything close to the amount of water that they had estimated, and that was before climate change began to further chip away at those water resources. But what happened is the seven states stuck to their original agreement. So, you know, to throw some numbers out there, they agreed on what the equivalent of 16 shares, and there's only, you know, 12 to 13 that flow through the river on average in the 100 years since then, but they still divide up 16 between the seven states. And so there have been wet years that have allowed some water to build up and store in the big reservoirs. But on average, those reservoirs are being drawn down, and the states are overdrawing and continue to overdraw today or until very recently the river's annual flow.
I mean, you have a photo in your piece of homes and golf courses in Summerlin, Nevada. It's a suburb of Las Vegas. In recent decades, hundreds of thousands more people have moved to the regions that depend on this river. And it just goes for what it looks like miles, home after home after home. You report that Phoenix expanded more over the past 10 years than any other large American city. The Colorado River supports roughly 15 million more people today than it did when Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992. So it seems like you have a couple things going on here. You've got massive, massive development, and then you have the climate crisis.
Yeah, and a third element, which is the agricultural use of the river. So the, you know, the way that farms and growing population demand water from the river, you know, is unsustainable by pure math. And that is, you know, one tension that needs to be kind of sorted out and solved for. But the second, as you mentioned, is what's happening with the climate crisis. And, you know, warming is affecting the flow of the river dramatically in a number of ways. It is changing the amount of precipitation that leads to inflows into the river. It is dramatically aridifying the land in the upper part of the basin, which is what happened this year. So the soils that are parched are taking even close to normal amounts of precipitation, but not transferring that water into the river. It just never makes it into the river bed. It's soaked up instead by, you know, thirsty trees and vegetation. And the third thing is the hotter it gets, the sun is just baking the river and its big reservoirs. And a lot of the water is evaporating off the top of the river and off the top of those reservoirs. And that's, you know, a natural process, but it also adds up to just an enormous amount of loss, and a loss that is really barely mathematically calculated into the equation for how the groups depending on the river share that water.
Sticking with climate, the climate crisis for a minute, you report that the Colorado's flow has already declined by nearly 20% on average from its flow throughout the 1900s. And if the current rate of warming continues, the loss could well be 50% by the end of this century.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the rate of change that we're seeing in the climate is expected to have a dramatic effect on so many things across the Western United States. But there's no reason to think that the Colorado River Basin and its supply of water would be spared from those effects. And so, in addition to the enormous pressures that the seven states sharing the Colorado River have imposed on themselves by misusing that water for so much time. Now they can, you know, it's difficult to forecast exactly what the drop in water will be, but they should plan on an additional 50% drop in the amount of water they have to use in the coming decades.
So let's talk about agriculture, because you've done a lot of reporting on this, and it's so important. 70% of the water delivered from the Colorado River goes to growing crops. Oh, that's 70%. That's a huge percentage.
And, you know, 70% is probably an understatement. That that number changes depending on where you get it from. It's as high as 80%, 85% even. So the vast majority of the Colorado River still goes to irrigate crops or pasture lands in the upper basin or, you know, planted crops in the lower basin of the river. That's a vestige of the agriculture boom that, you know, was built depending on this Colorado River. And it's also a sign of, you know, not only the extraordinary water demands of the crops that are planted that with that water, but the inefficiency of many of those crops and also how they're irrigated. So, you know, on a per capita basis, people, this great population growth in cities, they do use a lot of water, but they have been able to improve their efficiency and generally decrease the amount of water that each person uses. And that is a pressure on the system, but it is, you know, a pressure that has been held somewhat in check. The kind of water that's used for agriculture, on the other hand, is just so disproportionately large that, most of the experts I talk to, you know, agree that that is where there will have to be some dramatic changes in the future in the style and appropriation of a water use, maybe further regulation or different decisions about which crops to grow and who are served by those crops and where those crops should be planted.
Okay, so over 70% of the water goes to growing crops. And as you report, a majority of the water used by farms goes to growing non-essential crops like alfalfa and other grasses. And a lot of these grasses are exported to feed animals in the Middle East and Asia. You know, Abram, we have to have an honest conversation about this because we often hear that this water is used to feed the country. We do not hear enough about the fact that so much of this water is going to feed animals in other countries, as you report. I mean, that's what the facts tell us. So why do you think this aspect of this crisis doesn't get more attention?
Well, it's difficult to pinpoint, you know, what people pay attention to and why. But, you know, some of the foundational reasons for the agriculture water use, I mean, they go back to this idea of the water is appropriated for, you know, what's called quote unquote beneficial use. And, you know, that term, that idea of, you know, economic use coupled with, you know, the sort of rugged individualism of the culture of the West, I think, you know, has long led to a, you know, a culture of allowing individual ranchers or farmers or water users of various types, as so long as they have the legal right and a fair right to use that water, or to use it however they wish without being criticized for that. And that's been kind of the overarching you know, driving culture of the river's use for 100 years. And so to enter into a conversation about, you know, with more subjective terms, admittedly, you know, what is an essential crop or who, you know, is a valid recipient of the beneficiary of that crop. You know, that's a new kind of conversation that runs counter to that, you know, that sort of foundational ethos of, you know, individual rights to use the water as they please. But you're right. The fact is, you know, some of these crops are used, a large portion of these crops are used for feed to feed animals. A large portion of them are used to grow things like cotton, which, you know, many people don't think needs to be grown, you know, in the desert in Arizona. And a slice beyond, you know, beyond that goes to exports. As you said, there are both, you know, Middle Eastern companies that have bought up significant amounts of land with water rights in Arizona and mine that water and grow that alfalfa themselves. And then there are American farmers that are using that water to grow alfalfa. And, you know, the crops, all of them are commodities and they're sold on a free market, and alfalfa is no different. And it just happens that, you know, many consistent and high paying buyers are in those countries, those foreign places of, you know, China and throughout the Middle East. And so it's a complicated conversation to talk about how that should change and how markets, you know, would need to adapt or be reined in to do that, you know, not to ignore that complexity. But the fact is, I think we're approaching a point where those difficult decisions or conversations are what's necessary.
Right. We have to have that one in California. I mean, Mark Arox, who's written about water in California, says that dairy cows should not exist in California for this very reason. And you, this is a really interesting part of your piece. Short of regulating which types of crops are allowed, which state authorities may not even have the authority to do, it may fall on citizens to drive change. So do you know, Abram, do state authorities at this point have the authority to say, you know what, alfalfa just takes too much water, and if you're exporting it, we're going to help you transition to some sort of, you know, I don't, beans or something in an alternative way that doesn't use as much water. Do authorities have, do state politicians have the authority to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any clear answer on that. And, you know, I'm certainly not a water attorney. So, the answer is ambiguous to me. The experts that I talk to, point to the fact that there's no precedent for that sort of decision making, but that they think that there is, you know, some wiggle room in how, you know, that term beneficial use is defined and described. And that's really kind of the key, legal term, or the term that might be tested, if regulators were to, you know, take an approach to how that water is used. And it's worth pointing out that, you know, the water law is slightly different, in each state, and it is determined by each state. So there is no real overarching singular authority, and there's some variation. But some of the lawyers that I've spoken with who have expertise in Western water issues suggest that, you know, regulators could well redefine who benefits and what that term beneficial use means. And that's the way that they might in the future dictate, you know, how that water is used.
You write that water usage data suggests that if people in the U.S. avoid eating meat just one day a week, they could save an amount of water equivalent to the entire flow of the Colorado every year, more than enough water to alleviate the region's shortages.
Yeah, so this was just some number crunching that I did out of curiosity, and the numbers are astounding. And the suggestion, you know, is just as you said, that so much water is used to produce the feed for the cattle to create the meat, that reducing the demand for that meat, so long as it was commensurate with, you know, feeding fewer animals, would save that amount of water. And, you know, the numbers just leap off the page. It's just huge. I don't think the suggestion here is, that Americans will have their meat taken away from them, or should, or anything like that. But it's pointing out that culturally can't always have everything we want in unlimited, you know, quantities all the time and sustain, our way of life. And so the fact of diminishing water resources, is kind of irrefutable. And we all face a decision of how to divide up and use that.
Oh, Abram, are you still with us? I think we just lost Abram. Is Abram still there? Well, we're talking today with Abram Lustgarten, senior reporter investigating the climate crisis for ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. And we are talking about his latest piece for ProPublica, and it's called, I'm just bringing it up here, I hope you can take some time to read it, 40 million people rely on the Colorado River and it's drying up fast. If you have any questions or comments for Abram, he'll be with us for about 5 more minutes, and then we're going to talk about the water crisis in California. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Abram, are you back with us? Okay, I'm not
hearing. I'm here, yes. I'm sorry,
you're here.
I dropped off there.
Okay, there you are. Let's take a caller. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment and then a question. It's rather interesting to me that when I was, I'm 70, and when I was in the ninth grade, our history teacher said, if you want to understand the history of the Western United States, you have to study the water rights as they moved along. So my point my question is, the key to all of this is to start with the money, would it not be, on who's driving the dictation on how our waters are being used?
Well, thank you for that. Abram?
Well, I'm not sure it always correlates to, you know, to where the money comes from in the same way that so many other industries do. I mean, surely money's an influence, you know, but a lot of the historical water use, when you look at water rights in the West, and I'm thinking more of, you know, Colorado and Wyoming, California is slightly different. You know, but they're allocated based on what's called first in time, first in right. And, you know, what that basically means is that the people who came west and settled that land first retain the most senior rights and the most senior options for how to use their water today. And those rights can be far more senior than the cities that have come since them, cities like Denver and so forth. You know, so there are a number of water users on the Colorado River who, you know, who work hard and, you know, and need this resource and depend on it, and who, you know, do not have outsized influence or huge corporate influence, you know, in the American, you know, regulatory process or anything like that. But, nonetheless, you know, they maintain a senior water right because they were there first. And I do think the caller's right that there's, you know, especially in California, then the, you know, the agricultural interests become larger and more influential. And their, you know, their influence and lobbying in how, you know, in how water, particularly water cutbacks, you know, are made and distributed in the state of California, you know, is an issue, to deal with here.
Well, thank you for that question, Robert. You know, Abram, when you talk to farmers about this, what do they say? Because they know that what they've been doing just cannot continue.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I think the Zoom cut out again.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. We're having some, I think, some internet connection issues. When you talk to farmers about this, they know that this crisis is happening. So what are their thoughts about what's to come, given that 70% or more goes to agriculture? What do they tell you about what's in store for the future?
You know, it really, there's a range of responses. I spent a significant amount of time in California's Imperial Valley, filming a documentary film, you know, with the farmers and ranchers down there. And, you know, there are, a number of people who recognize the, you know, the extraordinary severity of the water crisis and are willing to, you know, to make changes in their use and reach some compromise that makes this resource sustainable for everyone, so long as they, you know, they feel like their individual rights are, you know, are protected and their livelihoods and way of life, you know, are sustainable. And there's probably ample room in terms of increased efficiency and other, you know, measures to do that. But on the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of kind of, you know, what I describe as more bullheaded responses that lean back on, you know, the seniority of those water rights we were talking about and, you know, and kind of just declare, well, we, you know, our rights are more senior and we, you know, deserve to use that water however we see fit, and cities shouldn't grow as much or, you know, allow more people to move there. And it kind of gets thrown back. So there's, you know, as with so many things in the West, I mean, there's extraordinary disagreement. What there also is, you know, as I mentioned, great opportunity to increase efficiency that can preserve, you know, the way crops are grown, but with less waste. So a movement towards drip irrigation can make just a huge, you know, difference. Lining and taking other measures on some of the canals and ditches that distribute the water can reduce how much of it's lost into the ground and how much of it evaporates into the air. So these are things that some of those farm communities and irrigation districts might have to come up with money to pay for. They're not inexpensive, but they're also ways to, you know, take less water and have it, you know, go a greater distance without, you know, without compromising what's grown with it, at least at the outset.
You also write, for all the hard-won progress made at the negotiating table, it remains to be seen whether the stakeholders can tackle the looming challenges that come next. Over the years, Western states and tribes have agreed on voluntary cuts, which diffused much of the political chaos that would otherwise have resulted from this month's shortage declaration, but they remain disparate and self-interested parties hoping they can miraculously agree on a way to manage the river without truly changing their ways. You write that this uncomfortable truth is that difficult and unpopular decisions are just now avoidable. So tell us a bit more about this and what's to come.
Yeah, you know, this boils down to the fact that there is no kind of dispassionate or disinterested party involved in the negotiations. Everybody that determines how the Colorado River is used has, you know, a personal interest or bias in the outcome. And that makes for difficult conversations. So, the river is divided between the seven states that it runs through, and the federal government has some influence in how the lower part of the river is managed, but not the entire river. And, while there's been some success in bringing these seven or eight parties to the negotiating table, and they've reached an agreement in recent years for how to make some modest cuts, as the river's supply decreases, the experts that I talked to are just skeptical that this kind of agreement can go on when the decisions get more and more difficult. So, you know, that's to say, it's much easier to agree on, 5 or 10% cuts to water to Arizona or to California. And those agreements have been made. But when you get to a future where, perhaps Lake Mead and the Hoover Dam are not viable any longer, and there is no water shortage there, or you get to a point where the Colorado River flow has dropped by 50%, how do you get those seven parties to come to the table and volunteer to give up what amounts to very important parts of the economy in their respective states? So it just becomes a much, much more difficult negotiation where what's being asked of the parties is to sort of sacrifice, all or part of the very thing that they're trying to protect and sustain. And the suggestion is, that perhaps what's needed is, a more dispassionate overarching authority over the river. It's unlikely to ever happen because of the rot politics, but the idea that you could have federal oversight once and for all over the entire river in a more sort of determinative architecture, has been floated by a lot of people as a cleaner way to go. What happens as negotiations get more messy, I think is anyone's guess. No one really knows the answer, but I think everything's on the table. Historically, there's been a moment where California and Arizona each sent, armed, state guard troops to the riverfront, preparing for, physical confrontation. That never actually happened, but it was a sort of a defining moment. And I don't think it's completely, out of the question that, that kind of confrontation could happen again.
Abram Lustgarten is a senior reporter investigating the climate crisis for ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. You can find his piece, 40 Million People Rely on the Colorado River. It's drying up fast, at yourcallradio.org. Abram, thank you so much for your important reporting, and thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And coming up after a break, we will talk about the water crisis in California. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.